This week on The Score, who are the Kurds and what role do they play in the politics of the Middle East? What can we learn from a movie about the economic bubble that caused a recession earlier in this century? Does the recent cold snap mean the coming winter will be colder than normal? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. News from overseas often mentions the Kurds and their conflict in the Middle East with the Islamic State and with Turkey. On the same day that Turkish President Erdogan visited the White House, an advocate for Kurdish political rights visited the University of Virginia at the invitation of Students for Individual Liberty. After Kani Zulam gave his presentation, I asked him about the Kurdish people and the political situation they are in. We spoke on Wednesday in Charlottesville. Most people in the United States probably don't know who the Kurds are. What is Kurdish culture? Where do the Kurds live? Where do they come from? And are there a lot of Kurds living in the United States?
Kurds live in the Middle East. We are the children of the soil. We live on our ancestral lands. Where we live, we call Kurdistan, the land of the Kurds. Right now, it's controlled by Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. We don't know exactly how many Kurds live in the Middle East, but we estimate some 40 million Kurds live there. It's not that we don't know how to count ourselves. It's because the countries that control us don't let us count ourselves as Kurds. In Turkey, for example, we're Turks. In Iraq, for a long time, we didn't exist, but now we do. In Iran, we have a limited status. We can have Kurdish schools, but all the way to middle school. After that, we have to learn in Farsi. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a country of our own. We want to have a place of our own under the sun, if you will. And so we are waging a political war. Some of us are fighting a military war, waging an armed struggle. I am a Kurdish activist. I, you know, use my pen, I use my tongue, I use my mind to advance the cause of the Kurds in Washington, in America. Kurdish culture, Kurds are Muslims in terms of their faith. We don't have a religious issue with our neighbors. We have an identity issue with our neighbors. Like, for example, in Turkey, Turks would like to dominate us. They would love to shove their culture through our throat. They want us to learn Turkish. They want us to study Turkish history. They want us to glorify Turkish race. And we are saying, you know, you could be who you are, but we are something else. And we have our own history. We have our own culture. We have our own folk tales. We have our own music. And they don't like that. So we have a struggle going on there. In terms of what do we want? Yeah, as I said, we want to be free. We want to live like other nations do. You know, for example, Latvians or Estonians or Hungarians. But we don't have those conditions yet.
In the grand scope of history, this Turkish oppression against Kurds is relatively recent. It dates to just after the First World War. Is that correct?
During the Ottomans, we were subject peoples of the Ottomans. Our language was not banned. Our culture was not disdained. We were tolerated we were taxed. Our able-bodied sons were recruited into the army during the wars. But, you know, we weren't free, but it was tolerable. After the advent of the concept of the nation state came to the Middle East in 1920s, after the First World War, we found ourselves in a disadvantage. In Turkey, the dominant race, dominant culture wanted us to submit to them. In Iraq, the same thing happened with the dominant Arab culture. In Syria, the same. In Iran, then dominant Farsi culture, Persian culture. So, you know, what's the trend? I don't know. In Europe, the concept of the nation state has a history of like 300 years, 400 years. Finally, you could say Europeans have, you know, security, have a semblance of freedom, have a semblance of peace, have a semblance of, you know, respect, tolerance. After trials, Napoleon and Hitler in between. And we're going through that period ourselves. We had a monster cult, you know, Saddam, for example, who gassed the Kurds. Now we have a madman called Erdogan. But the desire is there, the desire to be free, the desire to preserve your heritage, to, you know, for me to be able to teach my language to my children. Is a precious gift that I want to give to my kids. In Turkey, it's just not possible as we speak. There's a war against a culture, and it's completely unnecessary. It should, you know, Turkey should be disdained, if you will, should be exposed for what the crimes it's committing. But unfortunately, the West is not doing that.
With 40 million people, the Kurds are probably the largest ethnic group in the world without a nation state to call their own. And in a nation that large, there's got to be a wide variety of opinion about how they should be governed. You know, the Turks, Turkey would say through their propaganda that it's all undifferentiated PKK, Marxist-Leninist communists, a threat to the West, a threat to Turkey. But that's not true. There must be a variety of ways of life that the Kurds want to pursue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking for myself, I want a democratic Kurdistan. I want a free and open Kurdistan. I want, you know, the blessings that I have enjoyed in this country to be as much as possible duplicated in Kurdistan. Inside Turkey, though, the ruling circles, the Turks, for example, haven't allowed political Kurds who were nonviolent to flourish. So they were either imprisoned, they were tortured, like Mehdi Zana, the story I shared with you earlier, the Kurdish mayor. And only those who took up arms, they managed to stay alive. They lost a lot of fighters, but they managed to stay. And now they're a war faction, if you will. But they themselves have given up on the idea of free Kurdistan. They want, you know, an autonomous region. They want, you know, cultural freedoms. I haven't. I think it's unhealthy for one nation to dominate another nation, not just for the subject nation, but also the nation that does the dominating. I believe in greater happiness for greatest number of people. And I think one day Middle East will follow the European standard of nations respecting nations. We're not there yet.
How much of the current struggle, the current conflict, is due to Turkey's devolution from a functioning democracy to a dictatorship? And could Turkey once again become a functioning democracy, and that could lead to peace in the region?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The problem was, even before Turkey wasn't a functioning democracy, it was a functioning democracy for the Turks. Yeah. You know, it was like America was a functioning democracy before 1960s for the whites, but not the blacks. So today, Turkey is not a functioning democracy relative to what Turkey used to be, even for the Turks. And so it's for example, in 2015, when King Abdullah died in Saudi Arabia, Turkish leader Erdogan declared 3 days national mourning. Atatürk would have loved to have that be done, let's say, for John F. Kennedy. But Erdogan has another calculation. He really wants to turn Turkey into an Islamic republic. And he is not shy when he says, I want an obedient generation. He urges Kurdish women, Turkish women to make, you know, 5 kids. So it's an Islamic philosophy. I'm not saying it's bad. All I'm saying it's different. It's not democratic. Islam is a totalitarian religion. Once you're part of it, then you cannot get out of it. Whereas I want, you know, people to keep their faith if they want to, but not mix it with politics, because it's a recipe for disaster. Then you have Iran. In Iran, there are elections, but it's only those who are approved. You don't have elections like liberals and conservatives. And liberals don't take permission from conservatives to run for public office. They run for public office, conservatives run for public office. You, I decide who should be our representative. So Erdogan right now wants, you know, his party to dominate for life. He's changed the constitution where he could basically serve until 2034. He came to power in 2002. That would be like 32 years. The longest serving American president served 16 years, and that was because of the Second World War emergency conditions. He would be serving twice as many years. So democracy that was there, unfortunately, is on a life support now. And Erdogan wants to change it. He has taken basically government into his own hands. The institutions that the government of Turkey had, they were wanting, but they at least had them, are now dysfunctional. Like foreign ministry is basically a gopher for Erdogan.
We're running out of time, but I'd like to ask a bit about the Kurdish diaspora. Obviously, you living in the United States, what's your own story? How did you end up here?
My own story is in 1972, an American institution called American Field Service offered scholarships to 70 bright students in Turkey. I believe 68 of them were Turks and 2 of them were Kurds. And one of the Kurds was my older brother who came here and stayed with a family in Pittsburgh and went to high school here for his senior year. Coming from Kurdistan, he fell in love. He told his host family about Kurds. They had never heard of it. They thought they were getting a Turkish student. To make the long story short, he ended up staying, becoming a citizen, and inviting his siblings. And so I became a beneficiary of his smartness.
And if we were traveling around the United States, where would you find the largest Kurdish neighborhoods? Detroit, New York?
The largest one is in Nashville, Tennessee.
Really?
Yes. We have about 50,000 Kurds in America. We have about, Nashville has the largest concentration. The second largest is in San Diego. And the rest, maybe coastal areas have a little bit more Kurds. Then the rest are kind of like red pepper on pizza all over the country.
Well, Kani Zulam, thank you for your time today. I appreciate your talking to us on The Score from Bering Drift.
Most of us remember the Great Recession that started about 2008. Economists say it was the result of an economic bubble, but only a few of them predicted it would happen. Iowa-based documentary filmmaker Jimmy Morrison has produced a film called The Bubble that examines what happened 12 years ago and asks whether it can happen again. I spoke to him by telephone on Wednesday.
We're talking to Jimmy Morrison, documentary filmmaker, and you have made a film called The Bubble, which is about economics. And why don't you give us a quick sort of 30, 45-second introduction to that movie?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks again for having me on. The film is called The Bubble, and I'm glad you called it an economics film because we were very intentional about making sure it was not a political film. You know, you won't hear people talking about Republicans or Democrats. We're focused more on the actual policies and what the effects are on the economy. And so the idea behind the film was to interview people that predicted the housing crash and ask them why it happened, and more importantly, what's next. And it's kind of been a long project. I actually talked to you on the radio back in 2015, but we finally have this first film out that looks at the housing bubble and kind of looks at the past, like the Great Depression and things like that. And then we're finishing up editing on the sequel, The Bigger Bubble, which starts with the bank bailouts in 2008 and brings it all the way up to today to kind of give people a current events take on what's going on in the economy.
Where did you get the inspiration for the first film and then for the sequel? What brought you to the editing table, as it were?
Yeah, I actually dropped out of college back in 2006 with the idea of pursuing film, but I knew that people weren't going to invest in my projects as just a 19-year-old college dropout. And so I started a house painting business at the same time as a way of using the profits from that to fund my projects. And it was a good idea, but unfortunately I got in right as it was the peak of the housing crisis. And so as house prices came down and as people stopped getting home equity loans to fix up their houses, I felt the effects of that. And so I kind of seen it firsthand a little bit, but I wanted to get back into economics and just did a torrent search for the word economics audiobooks. And the book Economics in One Lesson came up by Henry Hazlitt. And he was writing back in the 40s, and, you know, there were parts of the book that did cover bubbles a little bit. And so it just gave me the idea that if he could write so well about this way back in the 40s, there had to have been people that predicted the crash this time around. And so that led me to the Austrian School of Economics and a bunch of the people that appear in the film. And so I actually wasn't even familiar with a lot of the content before I started the project.
Actually, let's back up a little bit and help us define what a bubble is in economic terms. I guess when people think of bubbles, if they're really into economics, they think about the tulip bubble of the Renaissance. And, of course, you're talking about the housing bubble of the early 21st century. But what is a bubble? How do you define it?
Yeah, I mean, I think lots of people define it different ways, but I think the general public would probably just define it as when people are just getting into an industry because they see prices going up, and so everyone's jumping in to just try to catch this huge profit wave. But as far as, like, defining it as far as economics, the way we look at it is there's interest rates in the economy. And right now we have a system where the Federal Reserve or the government is printing or creating insane amounts of money to push those interest rates down all the way almost to zero. And after the crash last time, they pushed them down to zero for almost a decade. And so what that does is it tells people who are looking at buying a house that their monthly payment's going to be less, and that, you know, it sends a false signal that there's a lot more savings and that the economy can handle a lot more home buying than it actually can. Home buying is just one example. You know, there's business debt and all sorts of things that are affected by the interest rate. But if something is, you know, if you're going to borrow money for a year or a few years for a car, that might be impacted. But if you're going to borrow money for 30 years, what that interest rate is can really affect you. So that's why one of the reasons that housing was so much more affected. And as we get into it in the film, there are a lot of other factors like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a lot of regulations that encourage banks to be in housing and to encourage people to own homes rather than rent. So there are a lot of factors, but we believe the root cause and what actually makes it a financial bubble is the Federal Reserve creating a bunch of money and lowering interest rates and driving people into this sector of the economy.
So would you conclude that the Fed made the wrong decision to try to solve the problem that it was solving, that it should have gone in a different direction?
Yeah, they, you know, sending the message that if you fail and if you go out and do something really risky and it doesn't pay off for you, sending the message that there's just going to be an endless supply of money that they'll just create out of thin air whenever you need it really sets us up for failure again. And we've seen it where we're in a similar situation where all these large banks and all these industries are just expecting the Federal Reserve to create money and loan it to them at basically no interest, and it's just a completely unsustainable system. And so I think it would have been much better if they let some of the banks fail. You know, not all the banks would have failed, but I think you have to deal with these problems instead of just kicking the can down the road, or it becomes even an even bigger problem. And we've really seen that in the last 10 years, where banks have really become much more centralized. They're much bigger than they used to be, and the ones that got the biggest bailouts have a much bigger share of the market than they used to. So it's going to be an even bigger issue next time, and we don't claim to be able to know when it's going to happen or predict timing or anything like that, but we do think that we can see that there are natural consequences to stuff like this, and that you can't just say, oh, it magically fixed the economy, when clearly there's all these problems that we're still dealing with today.
So essentially the Federal Reserve and the large banks are creating a moral hazard that's going to come back and kick themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Who are some of the experts that you consulted on the film? Who appears in the film talking about these issues?
Yeah, Tom Woods actually co-wrote the film with me. He's a New York Times best-selling author whose book Meltdown was one of the first to come out after the crash. And he was just an immense help. You know, I came to the table having read quite a bit about it, but he was able to really connect a lot of dots for me and introduce me to the people that I needed to hear from. So there were, as far as economists, there's people like Joseph Salerno and Mark Thornton and Robert Murphy. These are people that predicted the crash and have been writing about these things for a very long time. And so talking to economists was very helpful, but it also was important that we talk to actual investors and people that in the investment fields that really understand the weeds of how this stuff worked and what actually happened. And so we got to talk to people like Jim Grant from Grant's Interest Rate Observer, who's actually mentioned in the film The Big Short, and then Jim Rogers, Mark Faber. Mark Faber has predicted the savings and loan crisis in the 80s, the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, and Jim Rogers actually is one of the best investors, if not just in the last century, in all of history. Over the first 10 years of his career, the stock market went up by 50%, and his portfolio went up by 4,200%. So he retired at 37 and has basically just been traveling the world, living a very interesting life ever since.
I bet. We only have a few seconds left, so how could people see the film or films? Do you have a website? Is there a DVD available, a streaming service carrying it? Tell us how to find The Bubble.
Yeah, the film is thebubblefilms.com. You can get it digitally on DVD or Blu-ray. I should also mention Ron Paul is in the film, of course. But yeah, I'd love it if people would check it out. It's called The Bubble, and they can check us out on IMDb as well, or Twitter or Facebook. But the easiest way is thebubblefilms.com.
Oh, well, we'll be sending our listeners there. And Jimmy Morrison, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. This is a interesting topic. It might be above some people's heads, but I think that people will learn a lot by watching your movie.
Yeah, and we really think everybody can understand this film. So may take a couple watches, but there's something for everybody in there.
Well, what you need to do is distribute this to high school economics classes around the country and make sure that the teachers have the students watch the movie.
Yep, I think that's one thing it will be very important for.
Again, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to talking to you again when your next movie comes out.
Sounds good. Thanks, Rick.
When The Score returns, we'll talk to Virginia State climatologist Jerry Stenger about winter weather. Here's a brief preview.
Before you complain too much about the weather, man, right here, it really is a hard place to forecast for, because you're at the boundary between warm and cold, wet and dry air all the time, and things only have to bump 20, 30 miles one way or the other, and you get completely different weather, especially in the wintertime.
Yeah, and Northern Virginia is particularly prone to that, where, you know, you could either have a blizzard or a drizzle, you know, and it could go either way.
Exactly.
The commutes in the D.C. area are very unpredictable that way.
Yeah, it can be an unpleasant experience because when there's any frozen precip on the roads up there, everybody goes gaga over it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grew up in Milwaukee, and it's an entirely different attitude towards snow and ice.
You know, it's actually a very different kind of snow, because the snow in the Midwest tends to be a very dry snow.
That's true.
Because you're in the center of the continent. So it actually is a different kind of snow to drive on than the snow here that tends to be very wet. And usually right on the cusp of freezing. So it's actually a more icy, more difficult sort of surface to drive on. So it's not just to blame the people around here for not getting much snow and being used to it. A lot has to do with the type of snow we get here.
The Score will be back in a few moments, so don't wander too far.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. Virginia State climatologist Jerry Stenger has been a guest on The Score several times in the past, talking about hurricanes and blizzards. With the cold snap that spread across the country this past week, I wanted to ask him about the coming winter. We talked by telephone on Thursday afternoon.
It was funny. I was listening to the radio the other day, and I heard Bob Dylan's song, Subterranean Homesick Blues, which has the famous line is, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. And whether you take that literally or metaphorically, is that true? I mean, is it possible for us to know much about the weather without having a meteorologist or a climatologist explaining it to us?
To know much about the weather, you still have to have a little bit of explanation coming to you so you know what sorts of things to look for. But it doesn't take a lot of training in order to get some idea what the weather is doing, at least in the very short term, what we often call nowcasting. That's actually something we're pretty good at, is figuring out what it's doing right now or maybe a few minutes from now. It's when you get into a longer time frame, like a day or two or three, the things get really tricky, and you have to learn a lot more about weather forecasting to get that.
Yeah, and you know, just for some of our younger listeners who might be looking into getting into a profession, going to college, what kind of preparation do you need to become a meteorologist or to study climatology and use it as a profession?
Probably the best single thing that a student can do who's interested in meteorology or climatology or many of the sciences is math. I know that's a scary word for many folks, but apply yourself to the study of math, and as you go along, things will start to fall into place. It's really one of the fundamental things that helps to determine what's going on with the weather and the atmosphere, and whatever variation of climatology, statistical climatology or data analysis or meteorology that you go into, the math is going to be at the core of it.
And when you talk about math, you're not talking about simple algebra, but more like trigonometry, advanced geometry, when you study all those lines and squiggles on a weather map, that's all mathematically produced.
Well, actually, it takes math beyond trigonometry and analytical geometry and even simple differential calculus, really, to fully understand what's going on and have a big career in it. You need to go into integral calculus and into differential equations. There are some aspects of climatology and meteorology that don't quite require
one to be extremely well-versed in those things, but to have just a fundamental understanding of some of that, or at least an exposure to that, is quite useful.
And I suppose because math is such a universal language, that's what makes it possible to study weather on other planets like Mars and Venus. You don't have to be there to, you know, put your finger in the wind to see which way the wind is blowing.
Indeed, the mathematical part of it translates into just about whatever science you may be interested in, whether it's chemistry, physics, meteorology. They all cross over when we talk about the field of mathematics. And when you get into math, and it's that's the tools for understanding what's going on anywhere with most any process that's happening in the atmosphere, on the Earth, or other planets. We even have people here in the Environmental Sciences Department at UVA who study weather on Mars. A lot of times they're looking for not current weather conditions, but for features on Mars that may have been formed by previous weather conditions before mankind ever looked at Mars.
Well, speaking of studying what's going on right now, there's been a huge cold snap across the United States where even like the Gulf Coast is approaching freezing temperatures. And I understand that it's coming out of Siberia. Can you explain what the pattern has been for the past week or so?
It's important to note that we have what's often referred to as the jet stream that circles the globe. In this case, we're talking about the circumpolar jet stream in the northern hemisphere. This is a flow of fast air, a fast flow of air in the upper atmosphere that has undulations and squiggles and loops, and various waves in it that bring cold air often up from far northerly locations down to our area and pushes warm air in, depending upon where you are in one of these undulations. We call them ridges and troughs. And the jet stream becomes very much stronger in the wintertime due to temperature variations between the pole and the equator. So it flows faster, and it tends to get more waves in it. And these waves transport the warm and cold air north and south. It's part of how the atmosphere balances out the differences between the heat content of the air at the poles and the equator. And as it does this, it will bring along with it a very cold air mass that will cause us to cool off very rapidly. And then sometimes there'll be quite a nice warming behind that as the trough of as the ridge of that wave passes by. So when we get into this winter pattern, it's not unusual to see big fluctuations from day to day in the temperatures, and to see cold temperatures dip down further south and warm temperatures sometimes to get far north, maybe up into Canada and such.
When there's a big cold snap like this brought about by the jet stream so early in the season, we're still in fall, does that have any predictive quality for the rest of the winter?
That really doesn't predict anything when we get a cold snap in the late fall. It's not unusual for that to happen. Fall and spring also are what we call transitional seasons. They're where you're neither always in summer pattern or almost always in a winter pattern. It's where you shift back and forth sometimes. And being in late fall, we usually start winter climatologically speaking at the 1st of December. We're certainly capable of getting in a full-on winter pattern. And really, this wasn't unusual at all. We didn't see any record-breaking low temperatures in Charlottesville, for instance. And these things come along about this time of year. It's time to be sure you got your winter gear pulled out of the back of the closet.
And we're just reaching the end of hurricane season, which I guess ends on December 1st or November 30th. Has there ever been a time when there's been a big dip in the jet stream bringing cold weather to, you know, the middle of the United States, and also a hurricane is skirting along the East Coast?
We certainly had notable hurricanes late in the hurricane season, bring at the end of November, even into the 1st of December. But it's quite unusual to have a hurricane around or have anything significant out of a hurricane when the jet stream is very active and dipping far to the south. The jet stream is one of those things in the atmosphere that tends to blow hurricanes apart and to steer them way away from us. Very often during the height of hurricane season, if the hurricane gets in a position where the jet stream dips down and gets close to it, it will usually scoop that thing out of here post-haste.
I kind of anticipated that would be your answer, and this is a related question. I don't think I've ever heard of hurricanes in the southern hemisphere. Is the hurricane or the typhoon a northern hemisphere phenomenon only, or do they happen in the southern hemisphere?
There are certainly hurricanes, or as they're often referred to, typhoons, in the southern hemisphere, in the Pacific Ocean, but they are essentially unheard of in the southern Atlantic Ocean. So when we talk about the Atlantic hurricane season, by default we're talking about the North Atlantic hurricane season. In the Pacific, very strong storms can form in the southern hemisphere, and they go by a little bit different names than we use here. For instance, in the area of Australia, they're known as Willy Willys.
That sounds like an Australian term. Well, just to wrap up. Just to wrap up, and we may be talking again later in the season, but what do you anticipate the winter weather will be like between, say, now and February, aside from, you know, it's going to get colder and it's going to snow? What does it look like in terms of global weather patterns that will affect the East Coast of the United States and Virginia in particular?
Well, it's very interesting that people wonder about what the winter portends for us for this part of the country. Unfortunately, it turns out that the mid-Atlantic region of the U.S. is extremely, even notoriously difficult to forecast for. Not just short-range forecasts, 3 to 5 days or so, but long-range forecasts generally just don't work at all to this region of the country. They're really not something that is very useful at all, and I tend not to give out the long-term forecasts that have been issued by the Weather Service, because those folks also know that there are many cases where the forecasts for the winter around here just aren't very good, or not necessarily something one should rely upon. These forecasts are largely El Nino based, and when there's a strong signal of El Nino conditions in the South Pacific, there tends to be a little bit more validity to the forecasts in this area. But right now, we have no strong El Nino signal. It's either El Nino neutral or very close there too. And when that happens, the long-range forecasts that encompass the winter here just have essentially no reliability whatsoever. So I really caution people to just look at climatology, and I know that sounds kind of lame. To be blunt about it, we know it will get cold. Hopefully we'll have a fair number of winter storms come through here to help replenish the deep soil and groundwater during these colder months of the year, and it's hard to say how much snow we're going to get, even if I knew how much warmer or colder or wetter or drier than normal it would be, because it's the confluence of the cold and the wet that
that makes for snow. And trying to judge when they're both going to get here at the same time is simply not to be done. So look for conditions to be leaning toward normal, but not necessarily so. How's that for a forecast?
Well, in other words, don't go to an Atlantic City casino and try to bet on the weather 2 months from now.
I would not try to make any bets on that unless they'll give you odds on climatology.
Well, very good. Jerry Stenger, thank you for joining us again on The Score from Bering Drift. It's always great to talk to you. You have got some really interesting insights into how the weather and the climate work, and I appreciate your taking time with us today.
In anticipation of next week's anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, I looked back at a special episode of The Score from last November 22nd. This is just an excerpt, but you can hear the whole thing on our website at BearingDrift.com. In this brief segment, I talked to two eyewitnesses of the Kennedy assassination. Flash forward 50 years to Charlottesville, Virginia, where two witnesses to John F. Kennedy's assassination appeared as guests of the UVA Center for Politics at the 2013 Virginia Film Festival. One of them was Wesley Buell Frazier, an employee at the Texas Book Depository, who drove assassin Lee Harvey Oswald to work that morning. That was a day that changed his life, he told me in an interview following the screening of the documentary film, The Kennedy Half Century.
That young boy that went to work that day, he has never come home.
Just 19 years old in November 1963, Frazier had to endure a brutal interrogation by the Dallas police, who accused him of being part of the assassination plot.
Well, they wanted me to admit to being part of the assassination, and I told the guy, I said, I'm not doing that. And I said, that's ridiculous. You know, in this country, you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, but a lot of times you're guilty until proven innocent. Mm-hmm. And our forefathers didn't intend for our country to be like that.
Frazier explained that he had often driven Oswald from suburban Dallas to the book depository. Oswald's Russian-born wife, Marina, lived near Frazier's sister, while Oswald rented a room in the city. Normally, they carpooled only on Friday evenings and Monday mornings, and Frazier had pointed out to Oswald how it was odd he would need a ride on a Friday morning. Oswald had a long package with him that he said contained curtain rods. It turned out to be the murder weapon, a sniper's rifle.
It's a day like I've never seen before. I hope I never see one again. It's a day that changed my life. I've never been the same. That young boy that went to work that day, he has never come home. And for many years, I wouldn't talk to anybody about anything because I was so scared of what they might do to my family. There's some evil people in this country. And when it comes to power and money, they will do anything.
Once he was taken into custody, the police interrogator handed Frazier a pre-typed confession and told him to sign it.
I started reading it, and it's saying that, you know, I knew about and was part of the assassination, and I said, that's totally false. I'm not going to sign that.
That response made the police officer angry, Frazier recalled.
When I wouldn't sign that, he drew back his hand to hit me. Matter of fact, he was standing just like you're standing on there, and I threw my arm up like this to block, to keep him from striking me. And he got so mad when I told him, I said, I'm not signing that. And I said, there's policemen outside this door. Before they get in there, you and I are going to have a hell of a fight. And I said, I'm going to get some good licks on you. And I think for one time in my life, I think I scared the hell out of the man. Because I turned the tables on him, because that's what he did. He badgered and beat on people to make them sign confessions. And I think he found a kid that wasn't scared of him, and I think it scared the hell out of him.
Even though Frazier was what he called a young 19 at the time, that interrogating officer...
He didn't know what I'd been through before I got there.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
The other JFK assassination witness who came to Charlottesville 5 years ago, only a couple of weeks before the 50th anniversary of that tragic event, was Tina Towner.
She was the youngest person who photographed events at Dealey Plaza in Dallas as President John F. Kennedy's motorcade drove by. Seconds before the assassin's shots rang out, the 13-year-old's home movie camera ran out of film, but she captured the President and First Lady's car just as it turned the corner from Houston Street to Elm Street. Like Wesley Buell Frazier, Towner, now known as Tina Towner Pender, came to the attention of law enforcement authorities. The author of a 2012 book called Tina Towner, My Story as the Youngest Photographer at the Kennedy Assassination, Pender described what happened to the short piece of film she took that day in Dallas. Note that this is not the more famous Zapruder film, though it seems to have undergone similar scrutiny. The raw footage from her home movies, she explained, was processed by local law enforcement authorities, who had put out a call for any movies or still photographs that may have been taken by onlookers but had not been developed yet. Her family did not receive the reel back for several weeks. I asked her if, when the processed movie film was returned to her family, did they have any sense that it might have been tampered with?
Not at the time, other than it was on a reel, it was on the end of a reel of home movies. So we knew we were going to have to watch the whole reel of home movies before we got to the assassination part. And when we got there, it ran out. And there was no assassination film. And for a few seconds, we thought we didn't have it, that they didn't send it back to us. But it had been cut from the rest of the film, and it was there. It was just not spliced onto the end. It was just loose at the end of the. It was on the end of the reel where it should have been. It was just not spliced onto the rest of it. So my dad was able to splice it back on, and then we watched it.
About a decade later, Pender and her father took the film to a lab to be examined at the request of some investigators.
In the 70s, I was contacted by somebody who wanted to look at it in a lab, and my dad and I didn't let it out of our hands, so I went with him. It was a lab, Jack White, in Fort Worth, and he took it to a lab, and there were about three or four people there looking at it while I was there, and they turned to me and they said, "Did you know that there's a splice in your film?" And I said, and this was just the assassination film. This wasn't the whole home movie. And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, there's a jump in the film and there's a splice." And I said, "No." So they showed it to me. And it's as they're turning the corner, as the limo's turning the corner, you see a jump in the film. We knew that was there, but we just figured it was some sort of a blip in the processing or something. And it was spliced together. You could see where it was spliced, and it was not using materials my dad would have. It was more professionally done, and it was hard to see the splice when you looked at it. But anyway, I don't know who did that, and I don't know when it was done either, because that was in the 70s, and of course the authorities had it in 63, and then Life magazine had it in 67, and then I found it in the 70s.
Later in the 1970s, Pender was questioned by investigators for the U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations, which concluded that Kennedy's assassination was the result of a conspiracy and not the sole responsibility of Lee Harvey Oswald. She said her encounter with them seemed peremptory.
That was brief. They called and said they wanted to they wanted me to bring them the original film and the slides that my dad took. So I was working, and they came to my office, and they maybe visited, and questioned me for about 15 or 20 minutes, maybe 30, but it didn't seem like that long. And the questions were not very deep or probing, and it almost was like they just wanted to get it done with and take the film and leave.
Despite the attention paid by law enforcement and investigators over the years, neither Pender nor any member of her family who witnessed the assassination was called to testify before the Warren Commission, which was established by President Lyndon B. Johnson to investigate the killing of his predecessor, John F. Kennedy. This week, in our From the Archives segment,
I reached back to an interview from the Virginia Film Festival in 2010. Author and documentary film director Mary McDonough Murphy had just presented a screening of her movie, Hey Boo, Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird, which she also adapted into a book. From the archives, here is Mary McDonough Murphy.
My name is Mary McDonough Murphy, and I'm an independent writer and director.
Okay. I just saw the documentary, and I'm holding in my hands the book. Did you develop these two projects on a parallel course, or which came first?
The documentary came first, and in fact, I was about a year into the documentary when I realized that I had this incredible wealth of material, and I was never going to be able to get it all. And so I had been talking to an editor at HarperCollins for part of my research, and I brought him a 25-minute cut of the documentary and showed it to him and said, you know, Hugh, his name is Hugh Van Dusen, I think this could also be a book. And he said, write me a proposal. You know, so I did. And, of course, I knew the 50th anniversary of the novel was upon us. So I thought they might be interested, and fortunately they were. And so I did the book very quickly because I already had the interviews. I got the book contract in August, and the book came out the fall. And I was finished with it in January, and then the book came out in June.
Yeah, that's really a
fast track. It did.
Now, where did the original idea come from?
It was just my idea. I mean, I thought about it a lot. I obviously love the book, and as I said, it was my adult rereading that made the biggest impression on me. So when I sat down and sort of looked at all the research and looked at the phenomenon that it is, I decided that I could at least try to make a documentary. And then 3 or 4 days into shooting, different shooting dates into it, I realized that I could do it. I wasn't sure in the beginning. It's hard to make a movie about a book.
I don't know whether you had a chance to see Stanley Nelson's documentary, Freedom.
I didn't get here in time, but I really want to see it.
There's some overlap between your movie and his. Some of the same scenes.
Yeah.
And Diane McWhorter is one of his interviews, too. But I recommend that.
I really want to see it.
It would be great to see that on The American Experience, followed by yours on American Masters.
Right.
But just to go back to some questions that were asked in there, what are the plans for distributing the film?
I'm in the middle of talking to people right now about a broadcast and a distribution, so I hope that things will be sewn up and the movie will start being available in as soon as maybe January or February.
That would be great.
Yeah.
The question about how the book impacted the civil rights movement. Can you expand on what you found in your research?
Well, I think that many people have said this. I won't be the first, but like Uncle Tom's Cabin gave abolitionists fuel in the Civil War, and that was a hugely successful novel, many people have said that To Kill a Mockingbird provided important ammunition for the civil rights movement. I think the fact that it was written by a white woman, young white woman from the Deep South, did a lot in ways, as Mark Childress says in both the book and the movie, in ways that no treatise, no newspaper editorial, no politician could do. It was art, it was popular, it was told from the point of view of a child, and it allowed white Southerners and Northerners and everyone else to question the system and the way it was.
So. Final question is, what aspects of this novel do you think make it so widely read in school?
I think it's because this novel is about so many things, and it means so many different things to different people. So it's about race, of course. It's about class. It's about justice. It's about tolerance. It's also about childhood. It's about love. It's about loneliness. And I think it's an incredible novel of suspense. It has indelible characters. It has a social message, which, without being preachy, I mean, there are very few things, I think, that a teacher can take into a classroom where if you can't get the kid in the front row with Atticus Finch, you might get him with Boo. And then if the girl can't latch on to Scout, she might really be interested in Sheriff Tate or some other theme in the novel. And I think while everyone can chew on something in there, it's going to endure.
That's all the time we have this week for The Score. Be sure to return next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Don't forget to tell your friends where to find us, and feel free to leave comments and suggestions at BeringDrift.com. you are welcome to join the conversation. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.